Try to finish off our discussion about the purpose of having three dayanim. So if you recall, we mentioned a couple of possible explanations of what the idea of a beis din of three is meant to accomplish, which basically boil down to two ways to understand it for the most part. And this was discussed, we made a few references to the Sefer Gidrei Mishpat that observed along these lines, that one could say that the purpose of three dayanim is because you need to be machriya, you simply need to have a way of not having an even number or not having a deadlock, so therefore it's going to have to be an odd number, and three is this minimal odd number that allows us to be machriya. Or is it something else, which he attributed to the Sma, that the idea is Beis Din by definition is three because there's a certain minimal amount of Chachma that we need to have, and therefore perhaps we need three in order to get a better answer. So we discussed how questions like, for example, is two better than one, despite the fact that it's an explicit pasuk, Tov Mashnayim Min Ha'Echad, but for the purposes of Din, is two better than one? If we say that it's all about avoiding deadlock, so two is just going to give us the possibility of having deadlock. But if it's about increasing Chachma, so then two is better than one, even if it falls short of three. So to consider a few more questions in that area, first of all, it's interesting to note that the Sefer Shar HaMishpat in Siman Yud-Ches has a suffix which you don't really think about so much. What happens if you have three dayanim, but there's a big discrepancy between the level of learning of one and the other two? Ad kedei kach, that one could assume that there's more chachma in one of them than there is in the other two put together. Now, when we talk about undoing a takana of an earlier beis din, for example, so we refer to two standards, right? We say in beis din yochel levatel divrei chaveiro el im ken gadol mimenu be Chachma uveminyan, right? So we have two standards. We have the standards of counting the people, and we also have the standard of assessing Chachma. Obviously, it's a complex endeavor, but theoretically, that's something that we want to do. So to here, what if there's a split between Chachma uveminyan? What if there's two against one? So one could make the case that this possibility, which I think is a chiddush to think about this way, but we normally think a beis din is three, that's the whole story, 2-1 wins no matter what. But the idea that you might say differently, perhaps that corresponds with what's being attributed to the Sma, that the purpose of having extra dayanim is to add chachma. And if it could somehow be objectively determined, and again, it's hard to imagine exactly how you do this, but maybe it's theoretically possible to objectively determine that the one who's holding out against the other two is objectively equal to both of them, maybe that would leave us with some suffix as to how things should be managed.
Yes? Did Beit Din have a on the same
with, I'm sorry?
Did Beit Din have a covenant on the same with greater problem than the previous one? Did it happen?
Could it happen? Theoretically,
it
could happen.
Has it happened?
I don't know. I don't know exactly how to assess it, but theoretically it's possible. You're opening up questions which are interesting. This is not our topic today, but you know, the question of do we assume that there is a straight Yeridas HaDoros, that every later Beis Din is always going to be less qualified than the previous Batei Din, or do we assume that that's not necessarily the case, which I think is probably likely true, that we're not bound into a specific idea of Yeridas HaDoros, meaning that every earlier Beis Din is always going to be greater than every later Beis Din. It's theoretically possible, and it's always a question, I guess, of which two Batei Din you're comparing to. It's a good question. Do we have a record of a Beis Din being Mevatel, an earlier Beis Din's Zera, because of that specifically? It's an interesting question to bring up historically.
So Sma would say, in this case, that Beis Din would not be a good Beis Din?
I don't know if we say it'd not be a good Beis Din, because presumably the extra two dayanim added chachma. It's just a question that when we're trying to now decide which side won within it, so because the big guy is clashing with the other two smaller fish, then maybe if we're going to try to decide what the ultimate chachma that emanates from this Beis Din, it should go with the bigger one. In general, by the way, I want to be careful before saying, well, the Sma would say this, or that, you know, I think there's a certain synchronicity between the two positions. I don't know if we would necessarily assume they'd 100% line up, But the idea that one can pretend, where's the Shar Mishpat even coming from, right? Why can we even have such a discussion? Let's say, what the whole point of having three is so that we can say 2-1 and the two win. So the idea that you can even have a suffix about this seems to suggest that it's not simply about being able to have an easy vote, but it's about trying to get a greater level of chachma. And if we could say, well, looking at this lineup, the chachma is in a different conclusion, then maybe we would have to follow that conclusion.
Right, but doesn't the Sma seem to say that it's strength in numbers?
Strength, right, because so presumably the more you add, you're adding more chachma.
Right, but in this case, we're really not adding.
You're adding something because you added more give and take, but ultimately the position taken by the two seems to associate with less overall chachma. Then once we're dividing up into camps, most of the chachma, like if we could, let's say we could give points, right? So let's say we have senior dayan has 5 points of chachma, and the junior dayanim each have 2 points of chachma. So by bringing these two dayanim on, we went from 5 to 9 points of chachma for the discussion. But when we're actually looking now at the final vote, it's 5-4. The other way, so the conclusion should follow the 5. That would be what the logic would follow, which is an interesting possibility. So parenthetically, you know, we've seen a little bit about this in the past, but it's interesting also to ask, then, you know, we're basically asking what is it that the Beis Din is doing in their process, which relates also to questions that we've seen, for example, in terms of Malchus, or also let's say in terms of Geirus, which is Chakira, the Achronim Mass, you know, what is it that the Beis Din of Three, which we've seen associated with those issues too, not only with Dinei Mamonos, so what's the purpose of having a Beis Din of Three in those cases? Is it because somehow they constitute a Beis Din? Three is a definition of a Beis Din no matter what? And these things have to happen with the knowledge of the Beis Din? Or does the Beis Din do this? So, for example, Rav Chanan has a chakir in terms of Geirus, is the idea that the Beis Din has to happen in front of, the Geirus has to happen in front of Beis Din. They're like the Eidim for a wedding. So you have a wedding, so the Chas and the Kala are performing the act of the wedding, and you need the Eidim to be there to watch it, for it to be kosher. And so too, Geirus happens by itself, basically, you need a Beis Din to witness it? Or do we say that the entity of the Beis Din is actually creating the Geirus? And we saw already a similar question when we talked about Malchus. We know that Malchus, that's a din in our Mishnah, that Malchus Bishlosha. And we saw that it emerges from the Sefer Achinuch and probably from the Rambam, that means that the Malchus not only are assessed by the panel of three, but the Malchus are administered in front of the panel of three. So we could ask a similar question. We saw that Reb Chaim seemed to say that it has to be in front of three in order for it to be considered Malchus. That's the definition of the onus of Malchus. And that Reb Chaim and his Gilyonis, Reb Chaim disagreed and understood that the purpose of the Beis Din, I'm sorry, the Chazon Ish and the Gaon disagreed with Reb Chaim, and the Chazon Ish said that no, the Beis Din isn't there to make the Malchus Malchus. If you don't have the Beis Din, you'll still have Malchus, because the Beis Din is there to oversee what's going on and to assess, maybe you can't take it anymore, etc., etc. So we also could consider from this perspective a fascinating principle, which is called Kimli. We talked about that at all this year. I think we probably talked about it a little bit last year. So Kimli is a complex process, complex idea, by which, let's say, two people are engaged in a Din Torah, and the Muchzak, who generally has the edge, which is something we'll also expand on tomorrow, the Muchzak, the one who has the money, so he loses, basically, based on the halacha that is established through Rov Poskim. Rov Poskim are against him. So a Beis Din will want to say, listen, here you have Machlokes Rishonim, Machlokes Achronim on this issue, but Rov Poskim have taken a side against you. So Kimli says that this Muchzak can say, well, I know that Rov Poskim are against me, but there is a minority of Poskim that agree with me. So therefore, I hold like them. And as the Mosak, I have the right to adopt an opinion, and therefore, I'm going to win. So that's how some of the earlier sources write, that you could have a concept of kimli along those lines, that because we have a principle, ein holfin b'mamon acher harov, which is what we'll expand on a little bit more tomorrow. The minority is enough for the muchzak to win. And the Tumim asked on this, Rabbi Yonasan Eibshitz, and the Tumim says, what are you talking about? We have the same dynamic by a Beis Din. Right? So you have two poskim, two dayanim saying one way, and the miut, the minority, saying the other way. So why don't we say there also? So the mochzor can say, well, I vote like whoever the minority is. Right, what's the difference? So what would you say is the difference between the two? Right, so think about this for a second. So you have Reuven and Shimon in a Din Torah. Two Dayanim vote for Reuven, one votes for Shimon. Shimon happens to be the Muchzak. But he loses here because two Dayanim were against him. So we're not bothered by following that Rov, even though we say, Ein Holchim Mamon Achar Rov. But if this principle of Kimli is correct, if it's a Machlokas, the Rashba and Tosfos against the Rush, let's pretend those were the only three Rishonim in the world for a second. So Shimon can say, I hold like the Rush, and I hold the Malach and a Rov, and we'd recognize that. What's the difference between the two? Morty?
We said last year, we saw this year, and told us that, that the Rov by the Bishamana is out of the Rov.
Correct. So that's part, and that's something that, again, we'll expand on tomorrow, that we see there's a Tosfos in Bava Kamma, right, which asks the same question as Tosfos in our sugya, by the way, and gives a different answer, which is something we'll expand on tomorrow, because it's clearly a somewhat complicated topic. So I want to just kind of introduce it now and expand on it more. But Tosfos in Bava Kamma addresses the question of why we should ever follow a rove in a Beis Din, considering in Hocham Amanacha Harov. And Tosfos has the answer that the miut is keman delesa dami. In the Beis Din, the miut is ki'ilu, it doesn't exist. Now we'll have to figure out what that means, and again I want to expand on that more tomorrow. But whether or not you accept that Tosfos, which is certainly relevant, but whether or not you accept that Tosfos, so how else could you, can use that, you cannot use that, how could you understand exactly, in light of what we've seen so far, how we might distinguish between the Dayanim sitting on a panel together and Kimli principle? Are
you? You can say that the basin is actually creating the transfer, they're actually doing something.
Okay.
Whereas the Rishonim that exists, let's say, they haven't created any halakhic change. Someone can invoke a minority opinion, but they're not in front making the halakhic change that's happening in this mamonist case.
What do you mean by halakhic change?
I'm trying to say that the judges are actually posketing in this particular case, while the Rishonim exist outside of this case, and they're being invoked for this case if they apply or not.
So I think the distinction you're making, although I don't totally change the language choice, but I think the distinction, tell me if I'm right, is, and this is a distinction you do find sometimes, you know, certainly I think we refer to it in a few contexts, you do find this, that there's a difference between a psak in an actual real life situation and a psak in the abstract halacha. And that certainly there are ramifications. You know, for example, just this may or may not be relevant, but there is a Gemara Avodah Zarah that says that if a chacham prohibits something, another chacham shouldn't come and allow it. So there, the Mefarshim, later Mefarshim explain that we're not talking about an abstract machlokas in halacha. That always exists, right? It always could be that one posek could asser a concept and a later posek could disagree and agree it. So to whatever extent that principle applies, we're only talking about a certain actual situation where one postik asked something, then we're saying another postik shouldn't come and undo it. So it's an interesting question to explore. Is there something that changes in terms of the dynamics here when you're dealing with a real case as opposed to abstract halacha, which might be relevant here? I think there might be some other approaches, but there's another important difference to focus on, but that's not an irrelevant point, and that's something that definitely has a basis in halacha to consider. Shaul?
Most cases where we're showing to give a psak was more of a black and white case, or we have a very general idea, versus in real life where we have all different ideas flying around and different things that could cause other outcomes that the Rishonim didn't either think of or didn't put in their case.
Yeah, that's also a very important point. It's also not the only thing I'm looking for, but it's also incredibly important to be aware of, especially because in contemporary discourse that often gets lost, that whatever is the reason for a psak in a given situation is often complex and multifaceted, and it is challenging to take a certain conclusion based on an earlier discussion and apply it here and assume that you can, in full confidence, invoke the authority of the earlier Rishon, of the earlier authority, whatever it is, which is a very important point to come keep in mind. It was one of the reasons we study Gemara. Right, because many ask, why should we study Gemara? The Gemara has been paskined, and we now have later Sfarim, we have the Rambam, we have the Shulchan Aruch, so why learn Gemara? Why don't we just follow everything based on the later codifications, and what do we need it for? And Yisrael's point is well taken, that very often we have a certain maskana, and it's interpreted as if that maskana is the whole story, and really, who knows, it could be that it's more complicated, and there's a need for care before transferring that to the later sources. So that's a wholly different point from what Ari said, but it could actually supplement it. And still, neither point is the only thing we're looking for right now, but it's still also interesting that it could be that, listen, when we're dealing with Dayanim who are sitting here talking about this case, so we know their fully formed opinion about this situation specifically, and therefore, we can say we have the whole story in front of us. And we can allow the defeated opinion to be fully defeated. But if we want to say that this boils down to a Rashba and a Tosfos against the Rush, we don't really know how the Rashba would vote in this case. We don't really know how the Tosfos would vote in this case. So to say that the other opinion should be completely defeated, maybe we're a little hesitant to say that. We're basically imposing a judgment on the interpretation in order to apply it here. Is that along the lines of what you're saying? So that's an important point to consider, and it might be an explanation also, but there's still something else looking for here. Sammy?
Yeah, I guess this would be very different than the last point, which makes it seem like the Beis Din right now kind of is like very strong because they know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it's like the opposite in that the miut of poskim, I guess, is a lot stronger than the miut of judges judging a case now, because the fact that we have a psak that was passed down as part of our Mesorah, and we kind of accepted as peep as Rishon Rachman who have Chachma, is greater than somebody who would be allowed to come on a Beis Din and isn't necessarily a Samoch or something.
That's interesting. Actually, I think in the middle I was interpreting what you're saying a little differently than how it ended.
Okay.
But it's also, I mean, these are fascinating suggestions, because I think there's truth to all these suggestions. So it's interesting to, this is all definitely helping to inform the whole process of this whole debate. Still looking for something else, but these are all interesting points. So tell me if I'm interpreting it correctly, or I think in the last words something different. But you're saying, but they might be related. I think what you're saying, tell me again if this is correct, is that if I have a Rashba, which is a miyuta poskim on this issue. Okay, but he's a Rashba, so this Rashba is a part of our Masorah of the discussion. And it was written several hundred years ago, and it comes from the Rashba, and put all that together, this is a daya. But I have one contemporary dayan sitting on the Beis Din with two other dayanim, so maybe it's completely not going to get outside this room, that this dayan, this view, doesn't actually represent anything that has any history behind it or any authority behind it that Klal Yisrael should factor in, so it could be it's completely defeated and doesn't necessarily have an independent status. While the Rashba's Shita is not just a Shita that was outvoted in this room, it's a Shita Lahalacha that has been a part of our halachic discourse for a couple of centuries. An interesting point. Hi.
Well, we have the concept of Shoftim by name on hand,
mm-hmm.
that the judges act. You shouldn't say that you know, like, will we have Shmuel versus Yiftah?
Right, so thank you for the opportunity to clarify that, right? So the litigants in this Bezdin are subject to this Bezdin, right? But so they don't have to, and again, none of your answers so far are even looking for, but I think they're all worth fleshing out because they're all interesting points and they all contribute to the discussion. That's why I'm going to defend the position even though it's not necessarily looking for it, because again, I think it's interesting. That the difference is that you're right. So when you ask a Shaila, or when your litigants Hashem Bezdin, you can't say, okay, I insist on my Bezdin, should be your Kiva Eger and Ritva and Moshe Rabbeinu. I say, sorry, you know, that the Dayanim who are available to you are the Dayanim, and there you can't say, I don't paskin like you because you're not Moshe Rabbeinu. I don't paskin like you because you're not the Shach. It's not the way it works. But let's come at it from a different perspective. Okay, so fine. So you have those of these Dayanim, and the way a Dayan works, the way a Bezdin works, is the Miut gets knocked out, and fine. But the question is, let's ask from the other direction. So how come, when looking at a historical machlokas, why should we say, okay, I have a right to hold like the Rashba? The Rashba is knocked out. The Rashba was outvoted. So Sammy's point is, no, he wasn't outvoted. In the context of one localized Bezdin, maybe he would have been outvoted. But as a Shita, a Halacha, and it's a part of our Mesorah and a part of the discussion of the Sugya, it's Chai V'Kayim. So therefore, this individual has the right to acknowledge it and to bring it to his defense, even though it's not the majority. Which, you know, if that's the explanation, it's also interesting. Then I think we're straying a little bit, though, from, with all these explanations, we're straying from the stated reason, which is Ein Holchem Mamon Achar HaRov. Although maybe not. So again, tomorrow I want to expand a little bit on Ein Holchem Mamon Achar HaRov and see whether that being invoked is also consistent. Maybe it is consistent with these suggestions. But there is yet another issue to consider. So what else could you note from the fact that there's a difference? I think Tamir hasn't spoken yet.
Kind of relate to what we've been talking about when it comes to a basement. So they're going to give you a sack, whatever they say. That's kind of the end of the story. Mm-hmm. When it comes to more of a dintoro, where you're just coming to also kind of clear things up. But if you have, as long as you have somebody, that has some reason to think that, you know, the minority thinks whatever this, and the majority thinks that. As long as you have somebody that, you know, thinks like you're thinking, or says you're innocent, you can go like that, because they're not there to necessarily give a din, just to, it's like a lot of, kind of like the Chacham idea, there's a lot of different ideas, different things out there, as long as somebody says like you, so then, you know, you could go like that side.
You mean it exists as a view, as opposed to the Bezdin.
Right.
So let's go on that a little more. So what is there about the Bezdin context, maybe that would make the issue more decisively settled than the historical perspective? Right, so let's flesh that out. So why would it be that in the Bezdin we'd say this has been dealt with, while outside the Bezdin we would be less ready to say it? So we could say, let's say if we're following the perspective that's been associated with the Sma, that the purpose of adding Dayanim was to add Chachma. Right, that was how we understood it so far. So, how are they adding Chachma? Are they adding Chachma just by giving more players for the vote? Right, just because you have more people to count up? So, presumably, and this, you know, relates also, take it back a step, to the question Yisrael was asking before, right? Yisrael asked, so according to the Sma, if we came to the conclusion that one big Dayan could outweigh two small Dayanim, so then what did we gain by adding the two small Dayanim to him in the first place? Right? So what do we gain? Right? We gain that there's going to be give and take with extra Talmidei Chachamim of whatever level. And through that back and forth, maybe there's going to be a greater clarification. Right? Maybe even this greater Dayan, who outweighs the other two, maybe he could have been confronted with a svar he hadn't thought of. Maybe they could have out-argued him. But at the end of the day, if he maintains his position, even after they've said what they have to say, so then, okay, maybe he outweighs them. So a crucial part of the process, based on that, is specifically the fact that they're all sitting in the same room, and there's a give and take. maybe if we don't have the give and take taking place, then maybe we don't have that same mechanism. So it could be, listen, in the Besdin context, there's been a give and take, we have our assembled panel. Story's over now. That's the process. But in the long picture of halacha, with all the views that exist from different generations in different countries in different eras, so we don't view it the same way. This is a point I've heard indirectly, ABPA, I heard Rav Tversky Shlita quote this in the name of his grandfather of Soloveitchik, as explaining why Rav Soloveitchik thought that the halachic style of the Mishnah Berurah one could differ from. Right? This is a very important point as far as practical halacha is concerned nowadays. Right? The Derech HaPsak in general, not connected to Bezdin, but every halachic issue. So we know if you study the Mishnah Berurah, so the Mishnah Berurah style is basically to quote everybody. Very famously, for example, in Hilchos Eruvin, there's some cases that has a major nafkamina to this process, that he'll count up the Rishonim, and he'll say that, okay, the majority of the Rishonim say this way, that's the halach. Right, in a more limited sense, that's kind of how the Shulchan Aruch worked. Right? The Shulchan Aruch had three Rishonim, and this is Besdin of three, right? The Rush and the Rambam and the Rif, and basically went with 2-1 on all the issues, more or less. So that's an approach. But why might one differ from that approach, especially if you kind of expand it a little bit the way Mishnah Berurah did, beyond a big three? So why might you differ from that approach? So, if I heard correctly, Rav Tversky quoted from the Soloveitchik two reasons to disagree with this approach. Now, one reason is that we don't actually know if we have the accurate count, because we don't have all the dais of all the Rishonim on any issue. We don't have access to all the comments of the Rishonim that were ever written. So we have what we know about. I think I mentioned this in Kol Yom Rishon the other day, that we have an availability bias, that we have a bias towards information that we have access to. We tend to give that greater weight, not necessarily always recognizing there could be equally important information that we don't have access to. So we know what Rabbeinu Tam's view is on the dais where Tosfos quotes it. And the Rishonim quote Rabbeinu Tam, so we know what Rabbeinu Tam says. But there probably are many, many shittos of Rabbeinu Tam that we don't know about. And there are probably many dais of Rashi that we don't know about. And probably many dais of a lot of Rishonim that we don't happen to know about. So it's not like on every issue we really know what the lineup is of the Rishonim. We happen to know what has been quoted by other sources or what's been published in the Torah that we have, so we can make a count the best we can, but it's not necessarily reflected. Now, parenthetically, this ties into all kinds of other issues. Now, the Chazon Ish was of the philosophical belief that there's a siyata d'shmaya in that which is made available to us. And this was a major discussion that... And the question comes up, what about Gersos, manuscripts that turn up in later generations, and we find writings of the Rishonim that we didn't have in earlier generations, so should that affect the halacha or not? So that's a big debate, and the Chazon Ish was of the opinion that no, there's a mystical way to say this and a rational way to say this. You could say this mystically, you could say that a Kodesh Baruch Hu arranged the Hashgacha, that whatever sources were available at whatever time it was, and he was guiding the development of halacha that way. And so if a manuscript of a Rishon was not available during the time when this halacha was being hashed out, then it's not something that we still have, that's something we're still going to incorporate nowadays. Again, that's kind of a mystical way to look at it. Not everyone would agree. This was recorded, the author, the editor, Professor Lewin, put together the Sefer Otzer HaGaonim, which was a massive collection of the views of the Gaonim on all the Masechtas that he had. And to question a second, the Chazon Ish, he was very disappointed, he was devastated. The Chazon Ish commented on the fact that the yeshivas were not widely accepting the Sefer. It didn't become a bestseller in the yeshivas, So the Chazon Ish explains why. He said that the old stuff we have, and the views of the Gaonim that's already quoted by the Rishonim, so we know that already, and the new stuff we don't need, basically assuming that whatever wasn't there at that time is not going to be a part of the halakhic process anyway. Now, obviously, one could disagree, but that's one way to look at it, which reflects the fact that we don't have access all the time to all the views in Rishonim. So if we're going to say, it's meaningful to say, well, there's seven Rishonim against six, we don't even know that. We have no way of really knowing that that's actually the number. Shal Yaakov?
What makes somebody a Rishon?
Oh, okay, now, right, okay, so that's probably a Sunday topic. I'll just say it's not only being born in a certain century, but beyond that, obviously, what is it is a more complex question. And clearly not all Rishonim are equal. You know, that's it's also a part of it. So Shakespeare was not a Rishon, even though he's a great writer. Shakespeare would have been a late, you know, early Afron, I guess. But that's a different topic. I guess that's maybe possibly a Sunday topic. But so that's one perspective. So the rational way of saying, the less mystical way of saying this, let's hold off for a second until we explain the rough second objection. No, sorry, you have a question about this? You want to hold off for a second?
I just wanted to ask you about, I've heard Rosh Hashanah say, and this is kind of also on the side, but I've heard Rosh Hashanah say that not all go in.
Right,
yes, really,
because that ties into his question. Yeah, so we can come back to that at a separate point. But the second point is more relevant to us now. The second point, why we shouldn't necessarily just count up the Rishonim and take a vote, is because the Rishonim didn't constitute a Bezdi. They were not, the key phrase here is, they were not the Moshe of Echad. Right? They didn't all get together in one room and hash it out and have the Rosh to say this, and the Ritva said this, and then Tosfos said, well, I think this, and then Rashi said, your point is not a good one because of this, and then the Ramban was, okay, that would be something. You know, then the conclusion might be more reflective of a certain vote. But when they're not interacting with each other, and they're not exposed to each other's positions, and we don't know how they would have factored in everything, so that's fundamentally a different dynamic than a Beis Din. So just because we have a concept of a Beis Din coming to a maskana, and that maskana being complete and knocking out the minority, maybe that's not an appropriate model for looking at the machlokas rishonim world or machlokas achronim world and counting up views. So if you take that perspective, first of all, that's relevant to what we're talking about here, right? So that could explain then why you could have a concept of kibbutz and say that one is allowed to invoke a Rashba against Rav Rishonim while not having the ability to invoke a outvoted Dayan against the other Dayanim. Because maybe the whole element that negates the minority comes from the fact that they go back and forth and they have an exchange and then ultimately there's a conclusion. Which is also a part of the mechanism of the American jury system, right? The idea that the American jury system requires a unanimous vote, which is obviously a difference from what we find in the Sanhedrin, but the idea of the unanimous vote in the American system is, and clearly if you're going to just say, oh, it's also about counting up people's opinions, then you're never going to have a unanimous vote. It's pretty unlikely. So we'd have many more hung juries than we have. So the idea that we ever have trials that get finished in America that end up with unanimous votes is because the assumption is that even though they'll disagree at the beginning, but they'll go back and forth, and they'll argue with each other, and ultimately they'll come to a conclusion that they all agree upon. Right? So this is actually a good way to address, a good way to illustrate this view that's associated with this mount. That if we want 12 jurors to all agree, so then why do we need 12? Let's just have one. Right, if we're not going to have a vote anyway where one's going to outweigh the other. So besides the fact that it's an even number. But what's the point in having 12? So presumably the point is that even though they're all going to speak with one voice at the end, but having 12 voices in that process is going to increase the chance of a wise decision. So perhaps that's also the purpose of the Bezdin, where we not mock it on a unanimous conclusion, but the idea is that it should come through a back and forth in a give and take, where at least it's possible for everyone to say, okay, I've heard what you say, you've heard what I have to say, and here's how we conclude. So the Rav's point is that's not relevant to looking at machlokas rishonim issues, because you don't have that kind of interaction that's unique to Bezdin. It's interesting that part of the beauty of the Ksos and the Nesivis, who are involved in this whole story also, that we mentioned in the past that the Ksos and the Nesivis is quite amazing how they argue on almost everything. So it's very good for us as Talmidei based on Medrash that we get to have, you know, advocates for each side of an issue so that we can really flesh it out. They give us an opportunity on almost every issue in Choshen Mishpat to see two sides. It's really uncanny to have the Ksos and the Nesivis for that purpose. But one of the great gifts of the Ksos and the Nesivis is that they go for another end. Right? So there's the Meshovah of Nesivis, you get to read it again, they go back and forth, so you can have a couple of rounds, so that they can consider each other's opinion, and you can then see how they will respond to each other's objections. So that's particularly valuable. So it's that's a good question. But they do consider each other's opinions and go back and forth, so that's unusual. You know, you don't find that so much in other machlokas pairings throughout the halachic process, so that's particularly valuable. So it could be that that's what's unique about the Beis Din. And then it's not necessarily that there's anything inherent in the nature of the Beis Din, it's just that the process of going back and forth in one room is going to give you a certain quality of chachma that's not necessarily there with other aggregated opinions. And now to go back to what we said before, so this could be a more rationalist way of saying the Chazon Ish's position. You could say that, listen, it's not necessarily tied into hashgacha or anything so mystical that a certain day in Rishonim was hidden for us for however many centuries. You don't have to necessarily attribute that to it. But you could say, l'maisa, that when the Shach and Taz were taking their positions, so these were the Rishonim they had. And then when Rabbi Akiva Eiger and the Chasam Sofer were taking their positions, this is what they were building on. And when Rabbi Moshe was saying, Rav Adi Yosef were saying this positions, that's what they had to build on. And if this Meiri was just discovered now, it just simply wasn't a part of that whole process, so it can't be expected to have the same weight as if it had been there for the centuries and centuries that all the other halachic positions were discussed. So you could say that from a purely rationalist point of view. It's not that it was meant to be that we wouldn't necessarily have access to the area for all these centuries, but say simply there's a difference between a position of the Rashba that was a part of the discussion for 600 years, and it's not the case when talking about a view that could be equally old, but wasn't a part of the discussion during all that time. Hi.
The Rav was not for the Meiri being counting as a Rishon, right?
It could be. I heard things similar to that. I don't know. We may count it as Rishon. I guess it goes back to Shalyahu's question, but I count it as. But
that seems to align.
It could be. Again, we just saw two versions of Chazon Ish, right? So a rationalist version of Chazon Ish, which then works the same way with Shitasa, with the Rav's approach against the Mishnah Berurah, that if it's not, they're not all together. I mean, again, you can say Mishnah Berurah is not going that far. Mishnah Berurah is not talking about bringing in views. Sometimes he is, actually, but he's not necessarily talking specifically about bringing in views that weren't a part of the discussion, but he is saying that we can count up votes as if they were all arguing with each other. And the Rav would say that no, it's not the only way to view the development of halacha. That's a concept by Beis Din, but it's not necessarily a concept that translates as well to opinions that we're not going back and forth with each other. Okay. So again, so this all comes to a core of why do we want three in a Beis Din? Simply because we need to vote, or because that's going to maximize our chachma through the give and take of a few personalities. So this could affect a few other issues, just to mention, so that we'll be able to take it from here tomorrow. So there's also a question, what is the role of someone who says, I don't know, a dayan who says, Eini yodea, and then they end up adding dayanim. So is that Is he just nothing, Kamandalesa? Or is that a daya? That vote, I don't know, he counts as a daya against, you need a majority to outweigh him. So it sounds like from the Rambam, I think these Rambams were in the Marmakomos about dynasties, I don't know, adding on, was it on the Marmakomos this time around?
Yeah.
So, there's a right there, that whole, So that Rambam has been understood by the later sources as saying that he believes the Eini Yodea is a Deya who has to be outweighed. So for example, as later Svarim say, based on the Rambam, let's say you have five Dayanim, because you have a Dayanim. Two think the guy is Chayev, one think he's Pater, and two say, I don't know. So what should the conclusion be? What would you say? You have five Dayanim, because you added Dayanim. Two say Reuven is Chayev, one say Reuven is Pater, and two say, I don't know. So the Sma, for example, who's arguing on this, the Sma would say that those two who say, I don't know, they don't count. So it's 2-1, and the guy's Chayev. But later Svarim understand from the Rambam that the two who say, I don't know, they count. And therefore, it's two against two. The two who say it's chayiv against two who say I don't know. So you need to add more so that you'll get a majority of people coming one way.
The Sma says that they don't count.
Right. The Sma would say they don't count. The Rambam would say they do count, but basically, even though they're not adding anything really to the conversation, but we're all here to count up votes, and their votes count. And the Sma would say they're not adding anything to the discussion, so then let's leave them out.
Hi. Isn't that the Rambam says we need a roll over the I don't knows, or the I don't knows consider as a no, so we have more no's than yeses?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if that's... They both reflect the idea that the I don't knows count.
Yeah.
I think it could be read either way, which is an interesting question.
Is there a difference?
Because there might be a difference, let's say, if the money might have to go in two directions. You could come up with differences. But it's an interesting question to ask. I don't know if it's 100% clear for the Rambam one way or another. Except to say that they both build on the idea that the I don't knows are something. This is also relevant, by the way, the Rov question. So if you saw the Meiri, not Meiri, I'm sorry, I was talking about Meiri. So the Mordechai in Chulin, and about when we talk about Rov, so we're applying the principle of Rov to Dayanim. Even though when we talk about Bittel Barov, we normally don't apply Bittel when you have a situation of Kavua. Kavua is a very, very complicated concept. But the idea of Kavua basically means that it's not like you have things that have been separated. The idea of Rov was that called a parish, meruba parish. That which has been separated, we can assume it's been separated from the place of the majority. But what if something isn't separated? What if something is coming from an identifiable place? So then we don't apply Rov to that. That's called Kavua. So why don't we say Dayanim, they're Kavua. We know where they are. They're there in their offices. Sanhedrin is there in the Lishkas HaGazis. Isn't that Kavua? So again, that's assuming that the kind of Rov that we're talking about here is a Bittel B'Rov in the classical sense. While maybe when we're talking about Dayanim, it's not about a Bittel B'Rov in that sense, but it's about that the process of their Chachma is developed through their give and take. And it's a whole different mechanism. It's also interesting to note that the Kuntres HaSvekis, who was the brother of the Ktos HaChoshen, and was printed in the back of editions of the Ktos HaChoshen, he thought that a part of the process is that the minority has to concede to the majority, which is interesting. Others certainly didn't assume that way. And that part of the whole give and take, in that case, essentially, is similar to what we said before from the American civil system, the American jury system, that ultimately they're all going to have to vote the same way. And that the role of the process is that the majority should win over the minority. Which, again, I don't think that's the common way of seeing things, but it's interesting, again, in reflecting that really it's not about the majority outweighing the minority, it's about them winning over the minority. Which, again, goes to these two possibilities of understanding what exactly is going on here. Okay, this also is relevant to a tshuva of the Behuda. You know, the Behuda has a tshuva where he considers the question, it's the son's tshuva, some of the tshuvas printed in the Sefer of the Behuda in the second Chelek and Tinyana, after the son. So this is one of those where the question was asked, what if you have three Dayanim, and two say Reuven is Tayyip, and one says Reuven is Potter? But the two who say Reuven is Chayiv say so for different reasons. You know, let's say there is some kind of a business fight between Reuven and Shimon, and one Dayan says Reuven owes Shimon $100 because he wasted Shimon's time, and the other says he owes him $100 because he did damage to Shimon's business that he was doing. You know, two different svaras, two different complaints, basically. So is that three different positions? Or is that two positions? So ultimately, does it boil down to, okay, it doesn't matter why, but two say he's chayiv, one say he's potter, that's the whole story, count up the votes? Or do we say, no, the whole point is that there's going to be a give and take on the substance of the issue. And if they're coming from different places, they're coming from different reasons, so ultimately, that's not enough to consider the matter settled. So again, all of this goes to the core of what exactly is the purpose of having the three dayanim. So that's a lot of what we want to say on the issues. I think we'll just review now. But what this sets us up for us to finish tomorrow is to consider this unique role that we just alluded to of Rove and Miut, and to flesh out a little bit more if the general principle is Ein Holchen B'Mamon Acher HaRov. So how is it that a Sanhedrin is going to apparently reflect a different reality, allow Rove to be determined, to Mamonous issues to be determined by Rove? It's basically addressed explicitly in our Gemara on Daf Gimel, and we're showing him here and elsewhere with very different approaches as to how these principles either coexist or don't coexist. So, God willing, tomorrow we'll flesh that out a little bit, and then following that, we'll move into some of the other first paragraphs. Morty?
When you said the conscious figure says that the majority needs to win over the minority,
mm-hmm.
it means at the end that you're going to have a unanimous decision?
Yeah, basically, that's what it seems like. So, you know, basically, then what's the point in having all these votes? The point is not because you want to be able to count up more on one side than the other, but that the majority will win over. It's a unique approach.
What does that mean? So saying you're handing the votes?
So the point is not so we'll have two versus one, so we can just say, okay, it's 2-1, the two win, but then the next step is that the two have to actually use their influence, which, again, is a system that we have in the jury system. Right? So, again, why do we have 12 people on a jury if we could just have them? If we just want to get one opinion anyway. We don't care about adding up the votes. So apparently the hope is that through this whole back and forth, you're going to get a wider decision. So having more people on the panel is worth it, even though in the end they all vote the same way. Okay, so let's just recap the major points that we spoke about today. So we continued along this issue of trying to figure out why we have a panel of three dayanim. Is the idea that will just avoid deadlocks? Sounds like the Rambam is saying, or is it that increases Chachma, which sounds like the Sma'a's position? And we talked about various related issues, the question of what if you have a disparity between Chachma on one side and Binyan on the other side, so you have two Dayanim who are less wise than one Dayan who is equal to both of them and greater in his wisdom. That was a Suffolk in the Shahra Mishpat. We talked about a little bit about different possibilities as to what a Bezdin of three does for Geirus and for Malchus, respectively. We talked about the question of Kimli and understanding how could Kimli exist, the idea that a Muchzah can attach himself to a minority view in Poskim because of Ein Holchem B'Mamon Acher HaRov, and yet we follow two out of three Dayanim and knock out the Miut. And again, that's a topic we'll revisit tomorrow. It was mentioned Tosfos and Bava Kamma, very important position about this, but we had an interesting discussion where many suggestions were offered as to how do we differentiate between a panel of Dayanim and a panel of Rishonim from different eras. We had a lot of very interesting suggestions. I think we had the suggestion to distinguish between a specific situation in halacha and the abstract halacha, the difference between poskim who are not in the room with us, and it could be we're not fully understanding how their positions would be applied to this position that was Aryeh and Yisrael, respectively. We had Sammy's suggestion, and then we had Tamir's suggestion also, that maybe there's a difference between these classical machlokasim where we know the miyot represents a fully vetted Masorah position, and maybe that's different than a Dayan who gets outvoted. All of those very interesting, and we suggested a little bit differently, along the lines also of what Tamir brought up, that there's basically a give and take, and that's along the lines of the Sma, that that's the whole purpose, like the jury in an American context. And that's not the case when you're dealing with a classic machlokas, Rishonim or Poskim, and we got that whole discussion about the Rav's opposition to Mishnah Berurah style, that you can't necessarily count up Rishonim and put them in different columns, also because we don't have all the views, we don't necessarily know what everyone maintains, we just know what we know, and that might not be everything. We mentioned the Chazon Ish's objection to factoring later manuscripts against the Otzer HaGaonim, and how you could understand that in a mystical way, saying that there's hashgacha in terms of what we have access to, and that's the whole story. Or you could understand it in a more rational way, which is the Rav's second objection, that if there's not Moshe Becha, then we don't really have a significant vote given to the Rav over the Miyot. The Miyot continues to still have its power, and that could be also relevant to why we wouldn't necessarily include later manuscripts into the halachic process, if that's the position one wants to take on this. And that creates a difference here between a Bezdin and any other kind of machlokas. And then we saw how that could also affect the question of a Dayan says, I don't know, it's the machlokas, the Rambam. And again, this might perhaps the Shritasam about whether that Dayan is considered to be someone, like the Rambam seems to say, or considered to be negated and not count, like the Sma's position. And to consider also the question, the Kuntshos Fekus position, that, again, like the jury, that the Miyot has to be won over, and also the question that the Yehuda, the son, dealt with in Shuvas Nedev Yehuda, what if there are two Dayanim out of three who say the person is Chayiv, but they say so for different reasons, how does that all factor in? Okay, so again, tomorrow we'll focus specifically on the Rov and Bittel Shaila, and then move on from there. And, that's the plan. Okay.
Anyone want to split more down?